This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli of the website TV Worth Watching, Invertary Gross. Today, an interview with Meryl Streep. She's earned 17 Oscar nominations throughout her career and won twice for the films Kramer vs. Kramer in 1979 and Sophie's Choice in 1982. Streep is currently nominated for an Oscar for her performance in the 2011 film The Iron Lady, in which she portrays former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Before we get to Terry's interview with Meryl Streep, let's listen to a couple of clips from The Iron Lady. In this scene, early in her political career, Margaret Thatcher is speaking before the House of Commons.
The Right Honourable Gentleman knows very well that we had no choice but to close the school. Because his union paymasters have called a strike deliberately to cripple our economy. Teachers cannot teach when there is no heating, no lighting in their classrooms. And I ask the Right Honourable Gentleman, whose fault is that?
Methinks the Right Honourable Lady doth screech too much. And if she wants us to take her seriously, she must learn to calm down.
If the Right Honourable Gentleman could perhaps attend more closely to what I am saying, rather than how I am saying it, he may receive a valuable education in spite of himself.
Margaret Thatcher later took voice lessons from a drama coach to help her sound more authoritative. Here's Streep as Thatcher after those lessons, addressing Parliament about the war in the Falklands.
We were faced with an act of unprovoked aggression, and we responded, as we have responded in times past, with unity, strength, and courage. Sure in the knowledge that though much is sacrificed, in the end, right will prevail over wrong.
Meryl Streep, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for being here. And congratulations
Thank
on
you.
Your Golden Globe and your Oscar nomination.
Thank you very much for having me, Terry. I'm a huge fan.
Oh, wow. Thank you. So we just heard you before and after Margaret Thatcher has voice lessons to teach her authority and power so that she can speak more powerfully to the Parliament. Did she really have that kind of vocal training?
She did. My memory is a little cloudy, but I remember reading that Laurence Olivier had something to do with arranging for her to have. He demurred. He said he wouldn't care to do it himself, but he steered her in the direction of a good vocal coach. And she did go, and it did help her. And it was part of the Pygmalion process that Gordon Rees put her through.
So can you talk a little bit about what you think she learned with those vocal lessons and how you transformed your voice as her after she really learned her way around as a public figure and had the advantage of those voice lessons?
Well, I think that voice lessons really just bring out a voice that you already possess. So she already had whatever the sort of stentorian tones that she acquired over time, they were all lying in wait there and within her arsenal. And she'd also had elocution in her high school, the equivalent of high school, in Grantham. She had changed her way of speaking. Her accent from Grantham had disappeared by the time she went to Oxford to study chemistry. And she had decided on a sort of a plummy kind of aspirant, upper middle class, what we would call upper middle class voice. And so what the voice coach did was enabled her to expand her breath, deepen her voice, bring it to a place where men could listen to it in its most emphatic tones.
So how did you change your voice for the before and after, for the more confident and experienced Margaret Thatcher versus the early Margaret Thatcher?
Well, Well, I had evidence of both voices, you know, from the public record, so I could listen to them. And it's sort of my fun to sing along with records and imitate people that are on the telephone that have different ways of speaking. I mean, I pick things up like that. So it's not a thing that's a struggle. It's work, but it's not a struggle. It's fun. And she had a very particular way of emphasizing points and making her point. And that had to do with bringing out a word that you didn't normally think was the most important word in the sentence. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And she also had a sort of a way, like a railroad train, of going, taking a breath and starting quite quietly and making a point in a way that you don't really know that this point is going to be made through several examples, and there will not be a break in the speaking voice at any point. And you, if you think you're going to interrupt, you're really not going to have the opportunity, because she's just got capacity. It's just really stunning as I looked at interviews.
So you need a lot of breath to keep talking like that. Did you have it?
I've just been talking like that. Yeah. I did need a lot of breath. I needed much more breath than I have after all my expensive drama school training. I couldn't keep up with her.
I think it's interesting that when you're doing the voice of a real person, or I suppose if you're learning an accent too, you think of it as singing along with a record. So is that what you do, like you play Margaret Thatcher giving a speech and you do the equivalent of singing along with it? You give the speech as you're listening to it.
I say that because that's my way in, mm-hmm. in the very beginning, how to enter it. Very quickly in the process, I don't think about voice being separate from the way you hold your head or the way you sit or the way you dress or the way you put on lipstick. It's all a piece of a person, and it's all driven by conviction. In other characters, it's driven by insecurity, or it's driven by fear, or there's always a driver, and all the physical manifestations, you need your way in. So, yeah. When I was a kid, when I was 16, 17, I'd come home from high school, and my dad collected all of Barbara Streisand's records, and she was very young then. I think she was... She probably had 3 records out, and she was 21. And we had them all. And I knew every single song, every breath, every elision, every swell. And I sang along to it. But for me, it was a way to get out the feeling of the song and also to get out the feelings that, you know, royal in high school, to express something that I had no other way of expressing. And, of course, now I'm rich and famous, and I met Barbara Streisand, and I told her that she was nonplussed. She was just... We can't know what we mean to each other. You know, artists, you can't know that. But she was really important.
So you took singing lessons when you were young, didn't you? Did you study opera?
Yes.
I read that. Is that
I studied is that opera, yes. Uh-huh. I studied opera with Estelle Liebling, who had studied with Liszt, okay? Liszt's son. Okay.
As in Franz Liszt?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I'm sorry. That's how old I am, and that's how old she was. She was about 90 when I studied with her.
So did you expect to be an opera singer, or did you just
no,
want
I hated
to learn
opera.
More about voice?
I was 13. I didn't like opera. Ew. I liked cheerleading and boys and the Beatles and Bob Dylan. You know, I wasn't, but I loved singing. I loved it. And I did have a very good coloratura voice. Now I've listened to my high school music man just as I... You know, was getting ready to get the Kennedy Center honors with Barbara Cook, and I had gone to see her when I was a kid in the Music Man on Broadway. And I had sung the part in my high school production. We have a recording of it, and it's very good. Yeah. But it's a voice I don't have anymore. It's very, very high and light and free.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Meryl Streep, and she's nominated for an Oscar for her performance in The Iron Lady. She's already won a Golden Globe for that performance. I have another Margaret Thatcher question for you. Because you age several decades through the course of the film.
Four.
Yeah, so you had to wear, you know, like a prosthetic older person's neck, and your face has a lot of makeup or something because, you know, you age four decades. So is it harder to be expressive when you're underneath something? You know, either a lot of makeup or prosthetic or whatever.
Well,
I mean, you manage to be very expressive, but I'm wondering if it's, you know, more difficult.
It can be, but I didn't want it to be. So I've worked for 35 years with a master artist, makeup artist and hairdresser. That's Roy Helland. And he's done everything, bleached my eyebrows and hair for Sophie's Choice. And he gave me a brown mullet in Silkwood. And, you know, he got me ready for the Golden Globes. You know, he's always, always with me. And he understands the job and changing the outside to get at something inside. So in conjunction with this British prosthetics designer, Mark Coulier, he and Roy and I got ready maybe 3 months in advance. I flew to London three different times and we did tests, and it was all about taking away, taking away, taking away. You know, we start with what Mark would carve a sculpture of me. They took a life mask and then he'd add on with clay or whatever the material is, age. And then they'd cast it in sort of this silicone thing, and then I would wear it and we'd test it, and then I would say inevitably less, 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 less. So it's kind of remarkable how little I really am wearing. You don't know that. But the things that I'm wearing, it's minimal. But the things that are done are eloquent. So they trick your eye into thinking you're seeing an older person. You're seeing a lot of stuff where you're not. You're really not.
And when you're saying less, less, I want less, is that partly so that you can move your face and be expressive? Yeah,
it's all about being free and having, so that I can look in the mirror and see me, not stuff. And it all has to do with, you know, it's not about the audience. It's all about fooling the other actors into believing that you are who you say you are. Because that's hard when you walk on set and it's a big makeup job, and it makes it hard for them. And I take my entire performance from them. So if they don't look at me and hate me appropriately or love me the way they're supposed to, or find, you know, an old face but see the young one underneath, which is Jim Broadbent's task as Dennis Thatcher, then I'm lost. I don't have anything to go on because I can read that immediately in their eyes, you know.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way, that you have to convince the other actors that you're Margaret
Thatcher. That's the whole deal. The whole deal.
You gave a terrific commencement address at Barnard in 2010. And one of the things you talked about was how you think of your first character as being you in high school, when you wanted to be the pretty, popular girl. So what you did was you studied Vogue and Mademoiselle. And what were some of the things you taught yourself to do?
Bleach my hair, and curl it. And there was an elaborate thing because there weren't hot curlers in those days, so you had to go to bed sleeping on rollers, which is just a torture, like maybe sleeping on one of those Maasai wooden plugs that they put under your neck in the boma, you know, to go to sleep.
Did you ever use the tin can thing, understand. Putting a tin can on top of your head?
That was for the people with curly hair.
I
was interested in curling
my
bone straight hair, which won't bend, you know, under any circumstance. Yeah, but the girls with curly hair put it on can so that it would straighten it out
right.
during the night. Everybody was miserable.
So you said that you adjusted your temperament to in trying to be popular and appealing to boys.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
What did you
change?
I
remember that. Well, opinions took a back seat. Opinions were not, you know, attractive. I mean, this is stuff I remember thinking when I was quite young. You know, at my house, in order to be heard, you had to get your opinion. No, you had to get your opinion out. No, 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 don't interrupt me. You know, Dad, he did that again. And you just, you got it out. You learned to rise above the contending voices. But I recognized early on that that wasn't attractive on a date. Like if he said something stupid, you go, no, I don't agree with that at all. That's it. How can you say that? It's idiotic. And that would not get a second date. So I would learn to go, wow, yeah, cool, you know, and that would be okay. So it's a form of acting for a purpose, which girls learn to do, and girls are good at it if they care to be. Now, I don't think they, what do I know? I have three daughters, and they're all doing it on their own, in their own way. I mean, getting along in life on their own terms, and I don't feel they make those accommodations quite in the way we did. But this was something people did.
So did you think of yourself then as playing a role, or is that only in retrospect?
I wasn't thinking about playing a role at all. I was thinking about getting along, getting ahead. I was always a kid who wanted to do well, to get good grades and be a cheerleader, and whatever the contest was, I wanted to be on top of that. But when I got to Vassar, and that was a time when it was just girls, and I wasn't aware, Terry, of designing myself in high school. I wasn't. But when I got to Vassar, and all of that fell away because it was just girls, and it was the early 70s, and it was the classic consciousness-raising time when people were really earnestly talking about what's a woman, what's our role in the world, what is our capacity, what's holding us back, all those things, that I felt free. I felt a thing emerge, which was my actual personality and my actual voice, I guess. And just, I realized that I was funny and I was allowed to be, and I was allowed to be loud and obnoxious. And I took full advantage of it at Vassar and made great, strong friends who accepted me for all of those things. And, it was an emergence, which is what you hope for a kid when they go off to college.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Meryl Streep, and she's nominated for an Oscar for her performance as Margaret Thatcher in The Iron Lady. She's already won a Golden Globe for that performance. Okay, so here's a story I read, which I assume is true, but you can tell me if it actually happened, that for the 1976 Dino De Laurentiis remake of King Kong, you auditioned for Dino De Laurentiis and his son,
yes.
who were Italian,
yes.
and Dino De Laurentiis said in Italian, what did he say?
Che brutta. Perché mi... I don't know. I can't speak Italian anymore because I'm so old and forgetful. But he said something like, but this is so ugly. Why do you bring me this?
This being you.
yes. I'm sitting in front of him opposite the desk. He's smiling. He looks impeccable. He has everything beautiful. And his son is very kind. His son said, because his son had seen me in something. And he said, no, you know, Dad, she's a wonderful actress. And because I'd studied a year of Italian at Vassar, I could understand what they were saying. And I said, you know, mi dispiace molto, I'm very sorry that I'm not as beautiful as I should be. But, you know, this is it. This is what you get, sort of. And I left. I mean, I was very upset. I didn't show it. Yes, it's a true story.
So, a very interesting story, because you were being told early in your career, basically, that you're not beautiful.
Yeah.
You're not qualified. Your face is not qualified for this role. And you're also...
Face and body, I believe.
And body. But yes. Then you're also making the decision to let them know that you understand what they said. They were intentionally speaking in Italian so that you wouldn't understand them.
Right.
But you did understand them. You let them know you understood them. And
because they did. They think actresses are stupid. That was the other thing. Not they, because I don't think his son was that way. His son was my champion. I mean, he was the reason I was in The Office. But the dad, he wasn't being mean to me. He was just speaking to his son in Italian. But he had no idea that I would understand, because they think Americans are stupid too. So,
did you worry that you were basically? I mean, you hadn't been in any movies yet. So, did you worry that word would spread about you that you were spoke back to directors?
Ass?
Yeah, that you were a real pain and that you were that you were a problem. So, like, avoid her.
I am a pain in the ass. How can I hide it? I mean, that is the package, you know. But I was not probably suited to that role either. I mean, that was the truth.
How much did you want it?
Not much.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I did want a break, but I didn't think I would be good in it, honestly. I didn't. It represented something that, I don't know, I wasn't drawn to. So I suppose it was easier to be obstreperous in the meeting because of that. If it was an audition for Sophie's Choice and Alan Pakula had said something like that, I maybe would have swallowed it because I wanted it so badly.
You were engaged to the actor John Cazale, whom most people know as Fredo in Godfather 1 and 2, and in... Dog Day Afternoon. Why am I blanking on the title? And he had a small part in The Deer Hunter. You were nominated for an Oscar for your part in The Deer Hunter. It was like one of your first films. Mm-hmm. And so you were engaged, and he died of bone cancer shortly after in 1978.
Yes, we were not engaged. But we were a couple. We lived together. And yes, for like 3 years.
Mm-hmm. So he probably died not knowing how famous his roles were going to be, how famous those movies were going to be.
I know. He had the Godfather movies were unbelievably popular. And, you know, they were just, popular isn't the word.
They've entered into iconic.
Yeah, absolutely. And they did early. I mean, early on, they had that importance, certainly in New York, where we lived. And, you know, we would walk along the street, and people would roll down the window and go, "Hey, Fredo!" You know, and we could never pay for a dinner if we went to Little Italy. Never. Which was great. We went all the time. But he made 5 movies, and all 5 of them were nominated for Best Picture.
So how have one of the things actresses, I think, worry about, you can be the leading lady in your 20s and 30s, once you're in your 40s, it's really harder to get roles. There's character roles and, you know, the parent roles. I think things are starting to change. But have you been satisfied with the roles for women of your age as you've changed ages over the years? Or have you been frustrated with what's out there?
Both. I remember when I turned 40... I was offered within 1 year 3 different witch roles.
Literally witch?
Witches, to play 3 different witches in 3 different contexts. But it was almost like the world was saying, or the studios were saying, "We don't know what to do with you." And I remember, I mean, I've repeated this before many times, but I remember being shocked to find out that Betty Davis was 40 or 41 when she did All About Eve and was playing an over-the-hill, done, you're finished actress. And that she was only 50 when she did Baby Jane and Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte and those grotesques of, witches. You could call them witches. So, I think there was, for a long time in the movie business, a period of when a woman was attractive and marriageable or something. Not marriageable. I guess is the word.
You can't really say that on the radio.
Say that. Oh, okay. Well, you know what I'm saying. You substitute something better, but...
We could bleep it.
Okay.
It will have been bleeped by the time listeners hear that.
Okay. So that was it. And then after that, they really didn't know what to do with you until you were the lioness in Winter, right? Until you were 70. And then it was okay to, Driving Miss Daisy or Trip to Bountiful or things like that. But that middle period, what we call the middle, the most vibrant years of a woman's life, arguably from 40 to 60, were completely, nobody knew what to do with them. And that really has changed, completely changed. Not for everybody, but for me, it has changed. And part of it, I think, has to do with the fact that I wasn't. That word that I just said that you bleeped before, when I was a younger actress, that wasn't the first thing about me.
Sexuality was not the first thing, is what you're saying.
It was not the first thing.
Sexiness.
Yeah. Because when that goes away, cute. I was never cute. So when cute goes away, because that goes away with age.
So do you like seeing yourself on screen, or is that an uncomfortable experience?
I don't dislike it. I don't, pop in the CD, the DVD.
Let's look at that again.
Yeah. But I do think when, sometimes the scrolling through the TV and there's something on and I look at it and I think, oh, my God, I thought I was fat. What is my problem? when I was younger, I spent way too much time thinking about that. So stupid.
Meryl Streep speaking with Terry Gross. Streep is nominated for an Oscar for a portrayal of Margaret Thatcher in the film The Iron Lady. Here's a scene from another film for which Streep was nominated for an Oscar, The Devil Wears Prada. Streep plays Miranda Priestley, the demanding editor of a fashion magazine. Miranda is choosing an outfit for a spread in the next edition and trying to decide between two belts that strike her as very different. As she's deliberating, her new assistant, played by Anne Hathaway, is laughing to herself.
Something funny?
No. No, nothing's, it's just that both those belts look exactly the same to me. I'm still learning about this stuff and,
This stuff? Oh, okay, I see. You think this has nothing to do with you. You go to your closet and you select, that lumpy blue sweater, for instance, because you're trying to tell the world that you take yourself too seriously to care about what you put on your back. But what you don't know is that that sweater is not just blue, it's not turquoise, it's not lapis, it's actually cerulean. And you're also blithely unaware of the fact that in 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a collection of cerulean gowns. And then I think it was Yves Saint Laurent, wasn't it, who showed cerulean military jackets. I think we need a jacket here.
Mm.
And then cerulean quickly showed up in the collections of 8 different designers. And then it filtered down through the department stores and then trickled on down into some tragic casual corner where you no doubt fished it out of some clearance bin. However, that blue represents millions of dollars and countless jobs. And it's sort of comical how you think that you've made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry when, in fact, you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room from a pile of stuff.
That's Meryl Streep in the 2006 film The Devil Wears Prada. You'll find a longer version of Terry Gross's interview with Meryl Streep on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend. About 20 million people practice yoga in the United States. William Broad is one of them. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer for the New York Times and started doing yoga as a freshman in college in 1970. His new book, The Science of Yoga, examines what scientific research shows about the benefits and risks of doing yoga. In addition to examining the scientific research, Broad traces how yoga evolved from an obscure cult steeped in magic and eroticism to what some people now describe as the yoga industrial complex. Many people who practice yoga see it as a spiritual discipline. In his book, Broad acknowledges that there is much about life that science cannot address, much less answer. And, he says, many of yoga's truths surely go beyond the truths of science.
William Broad, welcome to Fresh Air. So you've been practicing yoga since 1970. What were some of the questions that occurred to you that you wanted to investigate as a yoga practitioner?
A basic question that had set me in a skeptical frame of mind came to me when I was working at the University of Wisconsin on a research physiology project. And while I was doing that, I learned that no matter how fast or slow you breathe, you can't change significantly the amount of oxygen that you take into your body. That's contrary to so many yoga teachings. The physiological truths and falsities of yoga were the thing that I was most curious about, and I thought it would be a pretty simple path to follow, but that turned out to not be the case.
So I just want to say here, you're still practicing yoga. You still find it beneficial.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But at the same time, one of the things you write about, and this is probably what's gotten the most attention from your book, is injuries that yoga can cause. And you had an injury. What happened to you?
This was right at the beginning of my book research in 2007. I was in a Pennsylvania studio, and it was an advanced class. About half the people in there were going through teacher training. And I got into what's called a side angle pose. And we were working as partners. And my partner was this beautiful young woman, and I was there kind of really strutting my stuff, right? I was leaning way far over farther than I had been before, and I was chatting with her, right? You know, and boy, everything was great, and I was really, you know, up to speed. I mean, I'm a cranky old journalist, right? And here are all these young, beautiful, flexible women, right? And I'm, like, feeling pretty good. And then my back goes out, and it's, you know, You don't think. It's everything is feeling. You know, there's fire in the base of my back. You know, I can't see the room for the tears. My knees collapse. I slam into a wall. I'm basically in a heap on the floor while all these people rush over. You know, what's wrong? And are you okay? And, you know, it was huge humiliation. Now, that wasn't probably an original injury, right? I've got a weak lower back, but I should have been smart. I was distracted, and I produced a bad injury that took a couple months to recover from.
So how did your injury practicing yoga affect how you practice yoga?
The injury didn't change me so much, right? I mean, I didn't do that particular pose again. It wasn't a pose that I did as part of my regular routine. But what did change as I advanced in my research was discovering what I call the super dangerous poses, right? The ones that can kill you or give you a stroke. And those things I've eliminated from my routine.
What are some of those?
They are ones that really bend your neck a lot. The shoulder stand, the plow, those kind of things. You're putting your neck, you know, if you think of the neck as usually going, you know, up and down in a line, you're rotating it around about 90 degrees. And it turns out that there are these delicate arteries that run through your vertebrae called the vertebral arteries, funny enough. And if they get tweaked around too much in rare instances, this is not a common thing, but the clinical literature is so clear, and I run through this in the book. You see it case after case after case. If you crank those arteries around and you're unlucky, you can tear the linings of the arteries, you can have clots, and you get up from that pose or you're even in the middle of the pose and all of a sudden those clots move into the brain and you've got brain damage. You know, some small fraction of people die, from that injury. Many of them have years of therapy that they have to go through to try to regain, you know, some of the lost functions. I mean, once I hit this kind of rough patch of research, I said, whoa, not for me. Thank you very much. I can eliminate that easily.
So the injuries you were describing come from what sound to me like pretty extreme positions. And it sounds like the number of people who actually have those injuries are pretty small. But what are some of the typical injuries that people practicing yoga get?
So this great guy named Lauren Fishman, who is an adjunct professor at Columbia University and is here in New York City, did this wonderful, enormous survey of more than 1,000 yoga teachers, therapists, and they found that the vast majority of the injuries that people suffered focused on the lower back. And then in declining order of prevalence, the other problems were the shoulder, the knee, and the neck. So it's mostly complex joints, right, that where people have problems. And you have dislocations and tears, ligaments, and, you know, all kinds of nasty stuff. So there it's a wide range, but generally you're not just talking about torn muscles, you're talking about joint problems in one way or another.
So you say in your book that you think up until recently that a lot of yoga teachers and yoga organizations were pretty much in denial about the downside of yoga, the possibility of injury.
Mm-hmm.
And now, has that improved?
Yes, there's been a market improvement. And if there's one thing I felt bad about with the New York Times excerpt of my book is that they didn't have the space to go into the reform movement. There is a very large, very intelligent group of people out there, I'd say led by the younger people, who are busy making yoga safer.
You want to spell
they
that?
Iyengar, Iyengar. He is one of the founders of one of the great branches of modern yoga. And they are using props to ease the poses. They use blankets with the shoulder stand to decrease that angle so your neck isn't flexed at 90 degrees. They do all kinds of smart things. And I couldn't believe the response I got to this New York Times Magazine article. You know, dozens and dozens of groups that I knew nothing about are out there refining poses, doing smart things. There's this group in New York City called Smart Bodies, right? They're yogis who are dedicating themselves to making yoga better. I mean, that's such a radical thought, right? Most people think of yoga as thousands of years old and perfect. Well, it's changing a lot, right, as we look at it.
Now, of course, you look at the benefits of yoga in the book. So let's go through some of the benefits that yoga practitioners and yoga teachers claim you get from yoga and see what science has to say about it. Let's start with spinal flexibility, helping to prevent spinal disc degeneration.
Right. There's all sorts of wonderful science, which I point out in the book, that shows, that illuminates that these claims have a lot to them, right? Spinal degeneration. They had an excellent study, a control group of people who didn't do yoga and people who did. And they came up with a very firm conclusion that the yogis had less spinal degeneration. And that makes sense. If you're bending it back and forth, you're stimulating blood flow, you're getting things cooking, and you can keep those pads between the vertebrae from drying out, which is a main problem of aging, right? We all shrink a little bit as we get older because those discs become desiccated, they become dry. So, you know, getting them, the fluids moving through them, it makes a lot of sense in a way, right? If you don't take it to extremes.
So cardiovascular benefits. What do yoga practitioners claim and what does science have to say?
You know, cardio is a complex issue because on one hand, yogis, especially aggressive schools, will say we are a great aerobic workout. As the book shows in a lot of detail, that's false. There's been study after study after study saying you do not get your heart pumping the way you do in aerobic sports like running, like spinning, like swimming, all that kind of stuff, right? On the other hand, yoga has this remarkable quality to relax you, to de-stress you. That means your heart rate goes down. That means if you're prone to hypertension, that lowers. There's all these wonderful cardio effects that come from just the other end of the spectrum, right? The relaxation of the heart muscle and the relaxation of the body, rather than the pumping up phenomena that you get from aerobic sports. And those things are really, really important, the downside, the relaxation side, because heart disease is a number one killer in industrialized societies. So the fact that yoga has this powerful benefit, which is not something that's routinely claimed by yogis, the fact that it's there is important.
Let's talk a little bit about how yoga quiets the nervous system.
Oh, it's a wonderful, amazing part of the story, and I enjoyed researching it so much. I studied with this wonderful guy in Pennsylvania named Mel Robin, who I think of as sort of the Einstein of scientific yoga. He talks a lot about the two sides of the nervous system, the sympathetic side and the parasympathetic side. The sympathetic side is kind of the flight or flight side, and the parasympathetic is what they call the rest and digest side. Yoga presses the rest and digest side. It presses the body's brake, right? It slows you down, and it does this on all sorts of levels throughout your body. They can measure it in the nervous system. They can measure it in the bloodstream. You can see it happening in the brain, all kinds of interesting scientific indicators of this effect. But it's pronounced. It's like we have two main energetic pedals in our body, the accelerator and the brake. And yoga is tremendous for pressing the brake.
So the effect of that is similar to, say, the effect of meditation. What is it about yoga that would give the same effect as meditation?
It is,
or a similar effect.
It's this, and it might work better than meditation in some ways, right? Because you're dealing with so many aspects. I mean, it's not just psychological and mental. You're also doing breathing. You're also doing these postures. If you're in advanced yoga, you're doing concentration exercises. So it's this sort of arsenal of techniques that that produce this relaxation response. Just the simple practice of breathing slowly, of inhaling slowly, holding it, exhaling slowly, holding it out. You do that for about 2 minutes, and that's a very common yoga technique done, you know, at the beginning of classes. You can just feel, especially after you've been doing it for a while, waves of relaxation. And it's not because you're holding in more oxygen. You're actually holding in more carbon dioxide. But that does all sorts of interesting physiological things, including helping press this this physiological brake.
So what does scientific research have to say about how this kind of breathing and relaxation while going into poses that stretch the muscles, how does that affect mood, and why does it affect mood?
You know, the overall picture is extremely complex, and science, as I try to show in the book, we're just on the sort of cutting edge of really getting a scientific grip on this. But you can start to see little glimmers of understanding coming in on all this. One of the great ones that I end the mood chapter on is this body of research that's been done at Boston University and Harvard up in Cambridge, where people looked at advanced yogis, you know, from many different styles, and they did brain scans, and they tracked neurotransmitters, and one in particular called GABA. And GABA is central in mood control, and acts as the levels rise, it acts as a powerful antidepressant. You know, and they watched these levels of these neurotransmitters rising as the yogis would, you know, do their routine, including all these poses and breathing and all that kind of stuff. They went up, and these people, and it turned out that the more experienced yogis had higher rises in GABA. You know, it's something that people know. Teachers talk about it. It's one of the many claims, you know, yoga, and it's the one thing that I felt overwhelmingly when I started in 1970. Yoga makes you feel really good. Well, we're just starting to figure out why, you know, and one of the reasons is that this surge in neurotransmitters.
Now, through the history of yoga, as you point out, there have been a lot of claims about how yoga can be like an aphrodisiac, how it can increase sexual feeling and sexual pleasure. And some yoga early on was apparently all about that. So has there been scientific research into the sexual effects of yoga?
Yes. It turns out that there's a very strong body of evidence. It's kind of hidden down there in the weeds, but you can see over and over people seeing rises in sex hormones, particularly in testosterone, brain waves getting zipped up in the same way that lovers' brains look when they're in deep pleasure. There have been these beautiful studies at the University of British Columbia where they show that even fast breathing, you know, produces very strong states of sexual arousal. And just recently, there have been studies done in India where they looked at more than 100 couples, married couples, you know, and who took up yoga and then had surveyed them, you know, before and after. What did this do to your sex life? And, you know, across the board, it's, you know, improvements in desire, arousal, orgasm, overall satisfaction. Men have better erections. Women feel more emotional closeness with partners. You know, it definitely does lots of good stuff.
So in order to get significant health benefits from yoga, is there a kind of general agreement about how often you have to do it, how much time per session you have to do?
No, I don't think there is a general agreement. There are lots of different paths and lots of different techniques, right? But what my teacher told me back in 1970, and I think this is true and it's a formula that works, if you ingrain this in your life and do a little bit every day, even if it's 5 or 10 minutes, that's how you get hooked and the benefits start to accrue. It's like, you know, putting a little money in the bank every week or every month, right? A little bit out of the paycheck. The payoff comes as, you know, these things start to multiply. So there is wide consensus on a little bit done with regularity is better than these kind of episodes where you don't do anything for a while and then start tying yourself into knots. That's where you get into problems.
William Broad is a science reporter for the New York Times. His new book is called The Science of Yoga, The Risks and the Rewards. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. You'll find longer versions of all the interviews heard on Fresh Air Weekend, as well as some extras, like a video of Meryl Streep's Barnard College commencement speech, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Thanks to our associate producer for online media, Melody Kramer. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.